a Politics Wednesday edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Today with Sarah Mitchell, the F. Wendell Miller Professor of Political Science at the University of Iowa in our Iowa City studio. Sarah, welcome back to our program.
Thank you.
Joining us by phone from Grinnell, Wayne Moyer, Professor of Political Science at Grinnell College. Wayne, hello to you.
Hi, Ben.
What a political week it has been. We're going to get right through it in just a moment. In a little bit, of course, we'll talk about the caucus chaos, and now we have finally results to talk about. I think we're up to 71% results being reported in, and when we you can call now, and when we get to that part of the program, we'd like to have you weigh in, especially considering what happened this week, the question on a lot of minds across the country here in Iowa. Are the caucuses good for our democracy? Have they outlived whatever purpose they served? A chance for you to hopefully try to detach your love of Iowa. We all love Iowa, of course, right? Detach your love of Iowa and try to think about this mechanism, the Iowa caucuses, as the first in the nation battleground. What do you think about it? 1-866-780-9100, 1-866-780-9100. Email us, rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. Before we get to that, let's talk about the State of the Union address by the president, the final of his first term. We don't know if it will be his only term, of course. Republican chance of four more years, we heard. Donald Trump taking credit for the robust economy, what he called a great American comeback. He says that he has ended the American decline. Not one mention of impeachment or the impeachment vote in the Senate later today. Let's listen to a little bit of President Trump last night during his State of the Union address.
If we hadn't reversed the failed economic policies of the previous administration, the world would not now be witnessing this great economic success. The unemployment rate for African Americans, Hispanic Americans, and Asian Americans has reached the lowest levels in history. African-American youth unemployment has reached an all-time low. African-American poverty has declined to the lowest rate ever recorded. The unemployment rate for women reached the lowest level in almost 70 years, and last year women filled 72% of all new jobs added.
President Trump last night during his State of the Union address. Sarah Mitchell, let me go to you. An effort there by the president to pick out various how well various groups in the United States are doing. Also, women, comment on that. Why the emphasis on those groups?
Well, I think there's an obvious electoral advantage to talking about changes in unemployment for African Americans and for women. So those are groups that support the Democratic Party in larger numbers. So mm-hmm. You can think of that as speaking to that audience.
Looking forward to 2020, the November election.
I think it's kind of interesting that a lot of the speech was compared to the Obama administration. So I'm trying to figure out, like, why is that? Because he still perceives that Biden could be the opponent. So he's juxtapositioning his record against Obama's. But, you know, some of the claims like unemployment, you know, Obama reduced unemployment from 10% at a high to 4.5%.
Mm-hmm.
And under Trump, it's been reduced 4.5 to in the, you know, low threes.
Right.
So
you could really characterize it. And, you know, Obama took hold during the crisis. He pulled the truck out of the ditch, as it were. And got it on the road again. We're at a slightly higher speed now, perhaps, under Trump. But that wasn't clear during the speech, or was it to you?
Yeah, I don't think so. The speech language makes it seem like things were not doing well under Obama. And then from Trump's presidency forward, things improve. So like with the stock market, for example, it is true the stock market has increased, but we also saw a 166% increase in the stock market under the Obama presidency. So again, it's saying that, yes, conditions are good, but to say that Obama takes no credit for any of those changes, I think is a stretch.
Mm-hmm. Wayne Moyer, give us your take.
Well, the speech was highly partisan, and it kind of reminded me of a campaign rally. And I think the reason Trump does this, I mean, he's just finished an impeachment process.
Not quite.
And
we'll have live coverage of that at 3 p.m.
From the
this afternoon.
In Congress.
Sorry, Wayne. Go ahead.
I was saying I think Trump did this to rally support at sort of as he's getting to the end of the impeachment process to show the American public that he has a strong base of support of Republicans in Congress.
Mm-hmm. Some moments there really in the U.S. Congress, in the U.S. House there that could have been reality TV. We had a surprise reunion of a military family, the president awarding a Presidential Medal of Freedom to the radio talk show host, the conservative Rush Limbaugh. Limbaugh recently announced that he had advanced lung cancer. Donald Trump talked about two pieces of potential health care legislation that remain a top priority for both parties in the coming months, the price of prescription drugs and a phenomenon of surprising billing at hospitals. Let's listen to part of his talk about health care.
And I was pleased to announce last year that for the first time in 51 years, the cost of prescription drugs actually went down. And working together, Congress can reduce drug prices substantially from current levels. I've been speaking to Senator Chuck Grassley of Iowa and others in Congress in order to get something on drug pricing done and done quickly and properly. I'm calling for bipartisan legislation that achieves the goal of dramatically lowering prescription drug prices. Get a bill on my desk, and I will sign it into law immediately.
Extending that applause there a little bit, chance of HR3. A note to go along with this clip, a fact check provided by NPR says President Trump uses the Consumer Price Index to support his claim that drug prices have gone down, but the index is considered an imperfect measure since drug spending overall has continued to climb. Now, you heard those chants of HR3 from Democrats in the House. This refers to a large bill on drug prices that passed the House in December, unlikely to be approved in the Republican-controlled Senate. Your thoughts on the health care comments in the president's speech last night, Sarah?
Well, again, I think it's smart to play to health care in the speech, given that the Democrats have focused a lot of their debates and discussion on health care issues. So I think this was a good idea to lay out Trump's ideas on these fronts. I think in terms of drug pricing, I think there has been some reduction of generic drug pricing, but not for brand drugs. So it's sort of a, gains in some areas, but not for other types of drugs. I think it's also interesting, right, that the Affordable Care Act, right, the administration has an ongoing court case trying to declare parts of the ACA illegal, and a lot of that has to do with pre-existing coverage, for example. So when talking about healthcare pricing being lower for premiums, part of that has to do with some of the plans that have emerged under the Trump administration having the ability to not cover people if they have pre-existing conditions. So that's one way that prices can remain lower, at least in terms of premiums for healthcare plans.
Mm-hmm. It's a Politics Wednesday edition of our program. Sarah Mitchell of the University of Iowa, Wayne Moyer of Grinnell College, our political scientists on board for this hour. Let's go to our first caller, David from Iowa City. Welcome to the program, David. What's your comment about the State of the Union speech last night?
Yeah, I just wanted to thank our guests for being on the phone. Always a great program. I just wanted to say, you know, I think the question was posed about why did he, what was the point of delivering the State of the Union kind of the way that he did? And from an outsider looking in, I see it that I don't think Trump really cares whether or not people like him. I think that his message, the reason he does that is at the end of the day, it's all about results. Mm-hmm. Much the way I may not like my boss, but I respect the fact that they're my boss. I think it's that approach. He's not trying to make, he wants votes, but he's not trying to make people like him. I think he knows he is who he is, and it's a results thing. You may not like him, it's his argument, but you have to like the results. And the results, that's why he's touting the results that way, constantly throwing them in the American space.
Right. Okay, David, thank you very much for your comment. And, of course, for his reelection in November 2020, it wouldn't hurt him to have more of the women's vote. It wouldn't help him to have more minorities voting for him as well. A tactical reason for those comments. Wayne Moyer, with your your foreign affairs expertise, I wanted to ask you about those parts of the speech we heard last night. For instance, he spoke of the two terrorists his administration has killed in recent months, al-Baghdadi, the leader of the Islamic State, also Soleimani, the Iranian commander killed more recently. Your thoughts on Donald Trump's foreign policy successes, not just limited to those things I mentioned, though?
Well, I think those two things have probably increased his popularity with at least a strong element of the public. The problem that I see is he says in the speech he wants to withdraw American military forces from the Middle East, but he's actually, at least in part, following the killing of Soleimani, actually increasing American forces in the Middle East. And so I think there's a dilemma here. Some of his actions are forcing him, at least in the short term, to increase the military presence, while in the long term he wants to reduce it.
Mm-hmm. Do you see, Sarah, do you see that contradiction as well?
Yeah, we have, in fact, increased our presence in other. You know, we had some withdrawal from Syria, but we increased our presence in other parts of the Middle East. So on net, we have more troops in the Middle East region under Trump than we did under Obama.
Mm-hmm. Back to health care and another sort of barb that the president had for the Democrats there. He used the State of the Union as an opportunity to paint health care plans supported by some of his Democratic rivals as socialism.
But as we work to improve Americans' health care, there are those who want to take away your health care, take away your doctor, and abolish private insurance entirely. 132 lawmakers in this room have endorsed legislation to impose a socialist takeover of our health care system, wiping out the private health insurance plans of 180 million very happy Americans. To those watching at home tonight, I want you to know we will never let socialism destroy American health care.
One of the larger applauses there. There were many last night in the State of the Union address. Wayne, let me go to you with this one. Attacking socialism, calling, he said, in this room, 132 lawmakers have endorsed what he calls a socialist takeover of health care. Now, this is, of course, referring to the Medicare for All system. Looking forward to the 2020 election, right, Wayne?
Oh, by all means. I mean, whatever the Democrats do, they're going to be accused of socialism. Doing away with private insurance, though, and linking that to socialism, I think politically does have some weight, and I think the Democrats are going to have to deal with that one.
Mm-hmm. Certainly observing or being present at a Trump rally last week in Des Moines, when I covered that, he have certainly had jokes and barbs for all the Democratic contenders, it seemed, as he went through his 90-minute rally speech. But socialism, he seemed to particularly enjoy casting aspersions on and trying to get to. I don't know your thoughts about how the president would do when faced with a Democratic socialist versus a more progressive candidate versus a moderate candidate in November, Sarah?
Well, again, I think the State of the Union speech is picking up on lots of themes that could run against different Democratic candidates. So, like I said, the running against the Obama administration could work well against Biden. Talking about socialism could work well against Sanders or Warren if they were running. When he talked about Venezuela, he also linked what was happening there to socialism.
Yeah.
So I think there was an interesting connection that he's trying to make to what's happening in other countries in the Americas with this theme that socialism is bad.
Another NPR fact check on this point. NPR pointed out that the plan supported by the Democratic presidential hopefuls Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren, they are not actually a socialized medical system in which the government runs everything. Listening to Trump's speech, you might think that government doesn't run everything, doesn't own hospitals, doesn't employ doctors. Instead, it envisions a universal health insurance program run by the government with privately employed doctors and privately run hospitals continuing to provide care. That information by the NPR fact check going on together with that State of the Union address. Let's talk about the visual impression of this speech. We had at the very beginning, bookending it, the interaction between House Speaker Nancy Pelosi and the president. Donald Trump at the start declined to shake the speaker's outstretched hand before he spoke. That Pelosi then, a few minutes later, omitted his ceremonial introduction after his speech, as Republicans were giving him an ovation in full view of the camera. As Donald Trump had his back turned, Pelosi matter-of-factly, it seemed, ripped up her copy of the speech, tearing it in half, tossing it on the table as the president in front of her soaked up applause. The interaction, one of the most anticipated moments of the night. Wayne, your thoughts on this mutual snubbing during the speech?
Well, I think this is directly related to the impeachment. Trump's failing to shake Trump's hand in some ways is a way of showing her how contemptuous he was that she went ahead with the impeachment process. Her tearing the speech up at the end is partly, I think, the content of the speech, but partly to show her general support for the impeachment process and perhaps contempt for the way Trump has proceeded through all of this.
Right. And during the State of the Union address, of course, the House Speaker has no speaking role other than that introduction, which she shortened so she could really, Sarah, communicate a message this way and indeed very strongly.
Yeah, I think, all of these interactions reflect not only the impeachment that's going on, but also the, really increased polarization that we see in general in our political system. If you look at the most recent approval ratings for Trump, there's an 87% gap between how support among Republicans for Trump minus support among Democrats for Trump. So 87% more Republicans approve of Trump than Democrats. And that's the largest gap we've ever seen in the Gallup poll. And I think, what happened at the State of the Union is showing that really, really strong divide in our country.
Right. And last night's State of the Union, a continuation, you could say, of what happened last year. Let's recall that last year's State of the Union address called off because of a government shutdown, this angering the president. He canceled a flight that Pelosi had scheduled to fly overseas. When it finally did happen last year, we had Nancy Pelosi clapping at the president in a notable image there as well. Let's talk about the impeachment vote this afternoon at 3:00. NPR, we, Iowa Public Radio, providing live coverage of that. I think there's some debate, and then perhaps is it today that there will be voting on the, by individual senators, Sarah?
Yes.
Okay. So this not one mention of impeachment last night during the State of the Union. Thoughts, Wayne, on why Donald Trump chose not to mention it at all? Because there was speculation, is he going to go headlong into it, perhaps off script, or is he going to keep quiet? He chose to keep quiet completely.
Well, he knew that virtually everybody in the room and probably everybody in the audience knew that the impeachment process was going on, and said that he didn't need to mention it. And I think what he was trying to do is to say that I have survived all of this. I have a great deal of public support. In fact, I'm ready to go ahead with a strong base of support that I have. And by not talking about impeachment, he's trying to change the subject.
Last night, Sarah, very few bipartisan moments. The chamber divided. One side standing up, sitting down, standing up, sitting down again and again. The other side mostly sitting down, hands not clapping. Democrats, women dressed in white. Why?
Well, we've seen this before as a symbol, right, of women's rights and
the 100th anniversary also of women gaining the right to vote. Also another one of the very few bipartisan moments. Perhaps you saw some other ones when the president made a mention of the First Step Act. This is some bipartisan legislation which overhauled criminal justice reforms. Speaker Pelosi jumping to her feet. Democrats out on the floor also here as well. Wayne, did you see any other or comment on that as a bipartisan moment in a very partisan atmosphere?
Well, there were just a couple of bipartisan moments, but not very much. I mean, it was as partisan a presidential address as I've ever heard.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, we're going to take a break and then come back and include several of our callers who are waiting on the line as we switch up to the other big news of this week. Following a near 24-hour delay, initially reporting the outcomes of the Iowa Democratic caucuses yesterday, the Democratic Party of Iowa began releasing results. I think we're now up to, I'll check in the break here, up to about 71% of precinct results. Buttigieg and Sanders at the top there. Buttigieg, Sanders more expected, right, Sarah, to be at the top, but Buttigieg somewhat a surprise.
Well, I think if you looked at the last Iowa State poll that came out, it had Sanders 1, Buttigieg 2. So
okay.
at least some recent polls.
Right, but we also have different
with this.
We have different metrics here. We'll talk about that when we get back. We have the actual votes. If you signed a preference card, your vote was counted, but also the apportionment of delegates that will go to decide who is the Democratic nominee. And when we come back, we'll get to your questions also. Are the Iowa caucuses good for democracy? Weigh in on that. 1-866-780-9100. 1-866-780-9100. Ben Kiefer with Sarah Mitchell and Wayne Moyer. More Politics Wednesday after a short break. Politics Wednesday edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Reminder again that we'll have at 3 p.m. preempting regular coverage for that impeachment trial. Proceeding there, the end is in sight, and we'll bring you that coverage beginning at 3 p.m. this afternoon. Sarah Mitchell of the University of Iowa with us, Wayne Moyer of Grinnell College, our two political scientists picking apart a considerable amount of politics around the country, and of course in our state. We want to focus on that this half hour. Following a near 24-hour delay in initially reporting the outcomes of the Iowa Democratic caucuses yesterday, the Iowa Democratic Party began releasing results. The Iowa Democratic Party has now released 71% of precinct results. Pete Buttigieg, nearly 27%. Bernie Sanders, just over 25%. Warren, 18%. Biden, 15%. Klobuchar, 12%. The rest, Yang, Steyer, Bennett, Bloomberg, at or less than 1%. But of course, the big story of the week was what has been called many things, but I'll call it the caucus chaos. That seems to be a favorite alliteration for us. Let's go to the Iowa Democratic Party chair yesterday. He spoke briefly to reporters about the delayed caucus results. Price said the party was committed to reviewing what went wrong and wanted to assure Americans these are accurate results.
But the thing to remember here, folks, is that we have a paper trail. We have always said all along that throughout this process that we have backups to this system, that we have redundancies built in. And one of the ways that we do that is through the paper trail. Now, the fact is that as we started doing this last night, it took longer than we expected. And so, but my paramount concern is making sure that these results are accurate and reflect what happened last night in caucuses across the state. We're going to do just that, and we're going to take the time we need to do that.
Iowa Democratic Party Chair Troy Price speaking yesterday. Wayne, let me start with you. Your thoughts on, the hiccup, more than a hiccup, a burp.
Well, certainly part of the hiccup is technology, but I think that's only part of it. Was this technology adequately tested? Were the people who were going to use the technology adequately informed in advance, educated about the technology? Did the people who were planning the caucuses think about what might possibly go wrong? And, did they think ahead about what might happen and be prepared for the worst case? Mm-hmm. And I think all of those things will need to be asked in the investigation. I also wonder whether what happened, even though my own caucus, I think, was a wonderful experience. It was the best one I've ever gone to. Whether the way this thing has turned out, it is hurting the image of the Democratic Party and the caucuses in general in an unnecessary way.
Mm-hmm. Let's get some feedback, input from our callers. Let's go through a number of them quickly here. Bill is in Cedar Falls. Bill, welcome to the program. Your comment on the caucuses this week.
Well, thank you, Ben. Yeah, thanks for taking my call.
Sure thing.
I wanted to look a little farther out. My wife and I have been involved in the caucuses for many years, and it's my hope and my belief that 15 or 20 years from now, the story of our campaigns is going to be, coming out of the hundreds and thousands of young people who have come out here to work, 2008 and on, but they're smart, they're dedicated, they're idealistic. They're gaining valuable experience. They're networking. We followed some of these young people and, are seeing them at the beginning of really great careers in public service and so forth. And so it's my hope that 15 or 20 years from now, many, many of these young people are going to be the ones who come forward in a great movement and really change our society and our politics.
Bill, thank you for your comment. Thank you for your comment from Cedar Falls. We have a lot of callers. Thank you for your call, Bill. We need to move on. Let's go to Eric in Des Moines. Eric, welcome to our program. You were working at a caucus site.
Yes, I was a precinct chair in Dallas County.
Mm-hmm. Tell us about your experience.
Well, there's a couple things. The first thing this morning, I heard something about somebody not getting the app until the weekend before, and I had the app a week and change before the thing was able to actually go through the process. They had a testing period, and I did it a couple times, and it everything worked at that point in time. Mm-hmm. And then the night of the caucus, everything was going fine. We had the first alignment, and then the second alignment, and then we had more viable groups than we had delegates, and so that brought up out the coin toss, and we did the coin toss, and the losing group did not want to realign with anybody else, and that's when I ended up with problems because I had no way to make the app. I had to account for all votes available in my precinct, and I couldn't any longer.
So what did you do? What did you do, Eric?
I ended up calling it in. Was on the hold for about an hour and a half.
Right. We heard about that very busy line. That backup put you on hold and many others on hold. And that, okay. But you'd agree, Eric, the system was not well enough thought through to accommodate.
The caucus went well for us.
Right.
And the people were wonderful.
Right. Reporting of the results. There was the problem. Okay, let's go to another caller in Des Moines. Thank you, Eric. Susan in Des Moines. Welcome to the program. We have a number of callers. Susan, please be brief. What was your experience?
I served as secretary of my precinct. The process was much improved from 4 years ago. It went smoothly. I think it's the problem was that the press anticipated being able to report results. They were not able to do so. The theme emerged of caucus chaos. There was no chaos at the caucuses. But, Ben, I'd encourage you to not fan the flames of calling this chaos, because the caucuses themselves were not chaotic.
Right. I think we're getting that nuance here, Susan. Certainly, I don't name things when they happen on a national scale like this. It's being called many, many different things on a national scale. And up above, I understand that with the point that you're making, but in reporting of these election results, people do expect in this day and age that the caucus results are reported in a reasonable amount of time. And I guess this is not considered a reasonable amount of time, so it became a story. We were projecting to have results on the evening in the caucus. That for sure didn't happen. In fact, we don't have our results, the entirety of them, as of yet. But Susan, your point taken. Thank you very much. Tom in Des Moines, welcome to the program.
Hello, is it me?
Yes, Tom, you're on the air. Welcome to
okay,
River to River.
Yes, thank you. Yes, I want to give a different perspective than your other callers and your expert there. I thought my particular caucus was extremely chaotic. They were not prepared to handle the up to 1,000 people, and they never gave us a particular number of caucus goers. But the chaos and the lack of transparency at my caucus, which was number 55 in Capitol Square, it represented the lack of transparency and the chaos in the reporting, which you cannot blame an app for that. You cannot blame the phone system for that. There should be 100% of all preliminary results reported by now. It should have been done on caucus night. This is just inexcusable. And David Yebsen on Christiane Amanpour's show last night gave a withering assessment of the Iowa caucuses, and people should go back and watch that, because
I think that was honest.
I'm hearing a lot of people who want to cover up this, right. And it's not right. There was a lot of chaos going on, especially in my particular caucus. There was never any public totals for the first alignment, the second alignment, or the delegate count.
Okay,
you had
Tom.
To go talk to the precinct captains for that.
Got the point. Thank you. Tom saying there was caucus chaos at his precinct in Des Moines, Dale in Davenport. What do you say to that?
Well, thank you very much, Ben. A couple of points. I don't have any insight into the reporting. Obviously, it's a horrible black eye. Our caucus in Davenport Central High School was extremely well run. Everything was very clear. The first ballot, the second, it was quite clear. I think the counting was a little chaotic at the end, but it was not total chaos at all. Extremely well run. Second point, I have numerous relatives from Europe. And several of the points that they were making was, yes, there's a problem in the reporting. Yes, it's given Iowa black eye, et cetera. They unanimously said, this is a marvelous form of direct democracy. This is a model for the world to look at and stress, and they would love to have a caucus like that anywhere. Mm. Those are my points, Ben.
Thank you. Very, very, very well taken. Thank you, Dale in Davenport. We have so much input here. Our time is running out. I want to get to our analysts invited. Wayne, let me go to you. Following that series of comments, a mixed bag from chaos to very well run from the precincts. And I believe every one of them. There was a mixed bag, it seems.
Well, that in some ways, that's democracy. you expect a certain amount of chaos, and you hope there'll be a certain amount of things that are well run together. Hopefully there'll be another caucus, and it'll be better run, at least in terms of reporting results, than this one was.
Okay, Sarah, your comments.
I think there are a lot of moving parts in terms of the rule changes that happened between 2016 and 2020. So some of the complaints by Sanders people and others were that they wanted more transparency in the caucus reporting and in essence changing the rules so that if you were viable on the first round, you couldn't switch. That's different, right, from historical caucus rules where you were allowed to realign, you know, in any way that you wanted. And so I think, at least in my precinct, the problem was that I don't think there should have been a single preference card. There should have been two cards. First card should have gone on the first alignment. If your group was viable, then you turn in your card and that's it.
Yep.
You should have then received a second card if you were not viable, because what happened, at least with my group, was that for the candidates that were not viable, half of the realignment time was spent returning cards that were mistakenly taken in that process. Mm. And so it really truncated the ability of people that were not viable in my precinct to realign. And so I've heard that happening from friends in other precincts, at least in Johnson County area. So I think, I think we tried to change the rules to improve things. What we'll probably do now is litigate the fact that the 2020 rules are problematic, and then we will make changes again. And then 4 years from now, we'll be using rules that tried to fix the problems from the last caucus. And I just think that's why we get into these problems. And you add on this technology problem of getting a different vendor and a new way of reporting. And that's why you, like I said, lots of moving parts that caused this particular outcome.
Of course, we haven't even talked about the outcome here, the results apparently showing Pete Buttigieg as one of the surprise victors here, along with Bernie Sanders. We'll see when those final less than 30% of the results come in. Wayne, comment on that, how you see the outcome, the apparent results here. I say apparent only because they're not all in, shaping this nominating race.
I think Pete has strengthened considerably. One thing that I noticed, especially at looking at the map of Iowa and counties and all that, Pete did very well in rural areas. And one of the problems the Democrats had in 2016 was the rural areas. And if Pete does well in the rural areas of Iowa, I think that's a good sign later. And also, Biden has faded somewhat, but I think Pete's in there for the long haul. And there's always the prospect of Michael Bloomberg coming in strong later. And the stronger Pete is at this stage of the game, I think the harder time Bloomberg's going to have later,
right,
regardless of the amount of money he's willing to put in.
I'm according to the results that I'm seeing from the Associated Press, Michael Bloomberg not being viable anywhere in any precinct in Iowa. Of course, he didn't run a competitive campaign here. He's now throwing a lot of money into the campaign, more money than he has before. Sarah, your assessment of the results here: Buttigieg, Sanders, Warren, Biden, Klobuchar, the top support getters.
I do think Klobuchar did better than expected. I think she had a strong ground game in Iowa. I think Biden did worse than expected. I was hearing from a lot of people that he was not viable in their districts, which I think was surprising. I think the problem that Buttigieg is facing is that his African-American support numbers are extremely low. Mm-hmm. And so if you compare him to someone like Obama, Obama had
Amy Klobuchar's, though, too, and it doesn't get nearly the press.
So the problem is that when you go to states like South Carolina, Biden has, you know, something like 54% of support among African-Americans that are surveyed. So it's going to be really hard for Buttigieg to build a coalition nationally unless he does something to improve support among that community. And some of the stories that have come out about the race relations within the South Bend Police Department are not helping him attract more African-American support.
Right. New Hampshire next week, then Nevada, South Carolina, which you mentioned, Sarah. So we're off. On these battlegrounds, various states, and of course, Super Tuesday, March 3rd, the big ones there, many states, but the biggest delegate halls there, California, Colorado, Minnesota, Texas, huge, March 3rd. Let's conclude this hour with a couple of callers who's been waiting to comment on the caucuses. We'll have to ask you to be brief. Summer, you're in Ames. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. I would like one of your experts to give us good reasons why the caucus is better than the primary. Mm. I think a caucus actually disenfranchises a lot of participants, and a caucus takes 2 to 3 hours for someone to attend, and many people do not have that time available.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Why caucus, Wayne?
Well, it has the quality of a town meeting. I get to see some people that live close by to me that I never see before, and sort of just meeting together with them, and had one person speaking for every candidate and speaking honestly. I think it plays an important role in making us feel part of the communities where we live.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
It has problems. I agree with that, but it has also some advantages.
But also there's a problem. Iowa would have a problem going to a primary because New Hampshire's there saying, wait a minute, we are the first in the nation primary, right, Sarah?
Yes. Yeah, so the reason that Iowa historically went first after Carter's success in Iowa was essentially that Iowa's caucus process takes a long time, right? Because it starts at a local level, it goes to a county level, and then on up. And so because of our caucus process, this created the advantage for Iowa to go first. I think there would be huge economic costs for the state of Iowa if we were not going first in the nation anymore. And so we would lose what is an incredible access to political candidates. I think Iowa is still a great place for candidates to roll out their ideas, to engage in what we call retail politics. And so I do think it would be a loss not only for Iowans, but also for the candidates if we went to a purely primary system where they didn't have the ability to talk about their ideas in a smaller state where there are a few key cities that they can visit and visit rural and urban areas. There aren't that many. If you think about doing this in California or Texas, it just becomes impossible to have the kind of retail politics that we see in Iowa.
Okay, edging up to the end of the hour, I hope we can squeeze in Steve. Steve in Burlington, if you're quick, we'd love to hear your comment.
I was the precinct captain in this town, and it took me a while to get logged in, but I did work on it early in the time period that we were authorized to access it, which was around 5 to 7. I think it would have worked smoother if they'd allowed us to log into that much earlier and then work out problems with the support staff if we couldn't get to our login problems. And that's where all of us ran into an issue. There was too many levels of security, and some of the information that was critical to log in was not provided to us. I had to call to get it. So it did stumble up some campaigns. But fortunately, I got my app up and running, and we were able to do our reporting in a very timely manner. We also streamlined our caucus and got people into position rapidly, and that gave us the liberty of giving them a good five-minute spiel. And I think that the interaction with the audience, having them to be able to make their campaign pitch, was very valuable to people, and they felt they had a good feeling come out of the caucus from that.
So I'm reading. I'm reading from you, Steve. We're running out of
briefly.
Yeah, go ahead quickly. We're running out of time.
The importance of Iowa is we're a gridded out on a one-mile grid system of roads. So you can hit 6 towns in an afternoon. You can talk to the white populace regardless of the time of year, because we're not a mountain state like New Hampshire with the White Mountains. Most states I travel and I go all over this country do not give us the possibility of getting these candidates up to speed in a place that is consistently a progressive leader on social issues.
All right. Thanks. Thanks, Steve, from Burlington, Iowa, I think, not Burlington, Vermont. Thank you, Steve. We've run out of time. And we want to thank Sarah Mitchell, the F. Wendell Miller Professor of Political Science at the University of Iowa, Wayne Moyer, Professor of Political Science at Grinnell College. Wayne, thank you. Sarah, thank you for an hour and spending it with us and our listeners. And thanks to the listeners who called in with their personal experiences at the caucuses and their thoughts. Sarah, Wayne, thank you.
Thank you, Ben.
Thank you.
River to River is produced by Rick Brewer, Caitlin Harrop, and Matt Alvarez. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. Help today also from Stephanie Nobrega. this afternoon at 3 o'clock, live coverage of the conclusion of the Senate trial right here on Iowa Public Radio. Remember, your comments, questions about this program, always welcome at our email, rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us. Thank you.